Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. My guest today says the past few decades have done a number on what we consider normal. And then along came COVID-19 and did a number on that normal. So many have been thinking about what life is going to look like post-coronavirus and what that new normal is going to look like. And for some, that's driving them toward a new, more sustainable way of living. So today I'm joined by the perfect eco-expert. Her National Geographic book can help you get back to basics with a step-by-step guide to creating a greener, more self-reliant way of living. Her name is Chris Bordessa. In 2011, she founded AttainableSustainable.net. And Chris lives in Hawaii with her husband, two sons, an abundant vegetable garden, and a menagerie of farm animals. She's a freelance writer, author, and obsessive collector of vegetable seeds. Her new book, again produced by National Geographic, is Attainable Sustainable, The Lost Art of Self-Reliant Living. Chris Bordessa is my guest. Well, Chris, congratulations on your new book. It is packed with delicious recipes, remedies, gardening tips, all kinds of great stuff. But before we dive into some of our favorite things, let's look at how this all began for you. It seems that how you were raised had a very strong influence on you. What were some of the key takeaways from your childhood that shaped how you view living naturally?
Well, as you say, that is my background. I grew up in an apple farming family, and we always had a vegetable garden. So, you know, the idea of growing our own food and producing our own food is something that was very familiar to me. However, my parents weren't really into any kind of organic growing. You know, they used chemical pesticides and such. So I've, you know, kind of taken the background that I had and morphed it into what works for me and my family as far as how we want that gardening experience.
Mm-hmm. And so at some point that morphed into up to the next level. So taking this to the next level for you, I read that you were having just a simple conversation with a friend, and soon after you created your blog, Attainable Sustainable. So how did that conversation go? What sparked the idea for this to take it to the next level for you?
Yeah, that conversation, I still chuckle about it. I was talking with a friend of mine who is a very, very smart woman. But it came about in the conversation, and that she did not understand that radishes grew underground.
Okay.
And you know,
I shouldn't laugh because there's a lot of stuff I don't know about gardening.
So that's it. You know, I thought this is a problem that if you know this smart woman doesn't understand that that's where the radishes came from, probably a lot of other people also don't understand this, and that is it's like. It's no fault of theirs. It's just that they were not raised in that sort of background, and you know they don't have that knowledge from their base. So you know, to me, it was, well, this is a chance for you to get it together and help these people understand that they can be growing some of their own food and that radishes grow underground.
Right. And I guess as you're writing your blog, as all us writers do when we're doing research and writing, we learn new things as we go along. So this became, it became bigger maybe than you thought. I don't know. Did you think it would become this big when you started it out?
No. I didn't. I mean, who could have imagined that National Geographic would be calling me to, you know, see if I wanted to write a book. That was not on the, on the radar at all. I wanted to get out there and reach people with these ideas that they could adopt in their homes. And, you know, that started out with the stuff that I knew from my own background, some of the recipes, the cooking, the gardening. And as time has passed, you know, I started this in 2011. I'm learning too, and this is what I want people to really understand, is that I haven't stopped learning. I'm still learning. I'm still moving forward as well. And so some of those things, newer things and experiments that I've tried as I go along, I'm also sharing that. And, you know, sometimes they don't go well. Sometimes my experience and my experiments just absolutely do not turn out.
Right.
And I'm, you know, I try to be pretty transparent about that.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'm not out here just trying to figure out some of this stuff like the rest of you.
Like the time I tried to make jam once, and when I went to open the jar, it was like concrete. I don't know what I did wrong. But these things happen. But I mean, this is kind of exciting because you're, what, 5 years into your blog, and you get a phone call from Washington, D.C., and there you are thinking, hey, I'm going to share my thoughts on the State of the Union, and National Geographic is calling on the other end.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of surreal. It was not something that I was expecting. But it's the certainly the beauty of the internet that I had created this platform, and you know, through just a little bit of Googling, they found me.
Mm-hmm. And so that resulted in the book we're talking about today, Attainable Sustainable. And I know this is a labor of love. Any book is a labor of love for an author. How long did it take you to put together?
We started working on this in 2016.
Okay, and it's just come out. Yeah, that's not bad. That's not bad. So let's... let's tell listeners a little about the book. It's got more than 350 color photographs, 50 recipes, 75 plus DIY projects. It's described as a broad survey of a variety of practical living skills to help readers achieve a more self-reliant, hands-on, homemade lifestyle. So, you know, in other words, you don't go into each subject in huge detail. This is a look at a broad spectrum of basic practical skills, and we can pick and choose what we want and learn more if we choose to, right?
Correct. I see this as really kind of an introduction to the possibilities of what people can be doing to embrace a more self-reliant lifestyle, a little bit greener lifestyle. You know, people can flip through this. This isn't a, you know, start at the beginning and read it to the end kind of book. I mean, it can be, certainly, but you know, you can poke through here and find something that looks really intriguing to you and try it. My hope is that if you find something in here that looks like something that you would like to try, and you try it and you love it, that you'll then pursue that. I have, you know, just as a for instance, I have a lot of I have canning recipes in here, and I can't remember how many canning recipes are in there. But if you've never canned before, it's a chance to try it. See if you like it. See if it's something that you might like to continue doing. And then, yeah, you can pursue it. I include at the back of the book a list of resources as well so that, you know, you can pursue that further.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this applies for anyone who, whether they live in the country or the city, there are tips and tricks in here that we can all adapt. So that's what makes it such a great resource as far as I'm concerned. I want to talk about living naturally, and you say that the number one tip to living naturally is all about attitude. So, you know, and I think that's true for life in general, but you say particularly your number one success tip for living naturally is attitude. So how does that apply to living sustainably, living a greener life?
Well, I think it's the idea of having an awareness that, you know, we can all go about our lives as we normally do and, you know, go to our meetings and do our things. And if we're doing that without a certain level of awareness, we can just plod through. If we are starting to become a little bit more aware of living more naturally, eliminating some of the plastics, the excess plastics that we have in our households, once we're aware of that, then we can start making changes. Until we're aware of that being a problem, nothing's going to change. It's still going to be very easy to walk into the supermarket and buy all of those things that are packaged in plastic. It's not going to matter to people who haven't noticed that. So, you know, that for me is just kind of introducing people to the idea that, you know, hey, this might be a problem. You're going to be bringing all of this plastic into your home, or you're going to be bringing that toxic cleaner into your home.
Right, right.
Throw things away.
Right. You know, often when we talk about living naturally, people just go, oh, I don't have time. I just don't have time. But that's not the case. It doesn't necessarily take more time. And especially if you start in the right places, and as you write in the book, you just take one small step at a time from where we are now, and things gradually grow.
Right. Yeah. I think every single person who reads this book is going to be at a different point on that path. And that's all we can do, right? We start from where we are.
Yeah.
And we start making those small changes and, you know, recognizing that, you know, maybe this is the thing that I'm, you know, falling back on regularly, and I could probably stop that one thing. So it's, you know, it's that awareness, it's breaking habits, and it's then instilling new habits in our life.
Right, right. And, you know, the number one thing I hear from talking with people, from talking with friends, colleagues during this time of COVID-19 is, I want to be more self-reliant going forward. You know, and obviously that started in the beginning when it was difficult for some people to get food at supermarkets, etc. But I've heard it from all kinds of people who've just never really thought about growing their own vegetables before. And now they're talking about wanting to be more sustainable. So, you know, I hope that trend continues, really.
I do, too. I hope that people, you know, there are going to be people who decide they want to try and grow a garden, and they get out there and they just really decide they don't like it. Because, you know, not everybody's going to love to garden. But I hope that there's a good percentage who realize that, wow, it does feel good to be outside and in the soil and growing things. I hope it sticks.
Right, right. So, again, given that we're in the pandemic situation right now, you know, millions of people are out of work, what I'd like to do is pull out some low-budget tips to get started. And obviously, and you've already said this before, but obviously people are going to be at different starting places. But I wonder if we can just look at a couple of tips that you'd share with people about how to get started if they're not doing this at all and they have very limited income. Where are some places they can start?
I'm a big fan of, and I guess this is just the way I grew up, I tend to be one of those people who thinks, I have a project that I want to do. What do I have here that I can use to make that happen, rather than I need to make a list and go shopping.
Right.
But that's my background, and that's how I operate. But just as an example of that is, if we're talking about gardening, a lot of people who are trying to grow a garden and they're buying seeds for the first time live in the suburbs, or even, you know, in an apartment with just a balcony area, and they can be planting a garden in containers, and those containers can be upcycled types of things that are generated in your home. I saw somebody the other day share a picture of growing carrots in a milk carton, because they're, you know, you need something that is deep enough to handle the carrots.
Oh, right. That's a good idea.
And you know, they had done that. It's not going to be a huge crop, but you can utilize that and use what you have on hand,
right?
Rather than going out and feeling like you have to go build a big raised planter bed.
Right. And, you know, one of the things I've done myself, for the first time, and I don't know why, because I ate a ton of it, I'm growing celery. And I just put, I cut it down and I cut off the base of the root, as it showed me to on YouTube. This was before I got your book. And I just put it in an old plastic ice cream container, a little water on my window shelf. I can't believe how quickly it's growing.
Oh, good. See, to me, that's super exciting that somebody is trying something new and it's working. And, you know, it might not be something that you had thought of doing before. And,
right.
Yeah, you can use whatever you have on hand.
What do you find the easiest to grow as far as vegetables go? Now, you live in Hawaii, so obviously it's going to depend what climate we're in. But generally speaking, what are, you know, some easy vegetables for us to begin with?
Right, yeah, my climate is going to really be very different than what you're dealing with. I find, and there's a couple things to consider if people are talking about growing food and growing in abundance. Radishes are very easy to grow, but radishes also, once you pull that radish from the ground, it's done producing. So that's something to consider. It's easy, it produces, you know, produces radishes, but then it's done.
Right.
As something like a zucchini plant, which also tends to be very easy, that zucchini plant will continue to produce zucchini all summer long. So, you know, you need to think a little bit about that too. What's your space? What's the likelihood that you're going to go back and replant radishes all season long so you have radishes?
Okay. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So one of the things I wanted to look at is fermentation, because I love sauerkraut and apple cider vinegar. And, you know, apple cider vinegar has many, many, many uses, as we know. So why do I want to do this? I've always thought fermentation was kind of complicated, but you make it look quite simple in the book.
Well, I tell you, fermentation...
Are you laughing because it isn't really simple?
It is very simple. But that's something that I didn't grow up with. My mom canned and, you know, made jam and jelly and such, so I grew up with that. Fermentation is something that I only came to, I don't know, probably in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe.
Mm.
So it's kind of new for me, but it is. It's incredibly easy. And sauerkraut is one. Sauerkraut, the recipe for sauerkraut is not in my book. It is on my website, but very easy. All it is cabbage and salt. That's all you need is cabbage and salt. And,
wow.
You know, you can embellish it if you want. You could, you know, grate a carrot into it or... add little bits of other things, but it's easy to make. I keep it on hand here almost all the time. So it's a matter of sliced cabbage, or even, you know, small diced cabbage, tossed with salt, and massaged a little bit. And what will happen is that cabbage will start to, it'll release juices. And then when you press that down into a jar, you won't think so at first, but as you press it down, and then you do use kind of a pounder to really pack it in there,
mm-hmm.
there will be enough juice to cover the cabbage bits.
Interesting. I'm going to try that then, because I, like I said, I'm a huge fan, and that definitely sounds simple enough for me to manage.
Yeah. The real key to fermenting anything is that you really need to have the whatever it is you're fermenting submerged underwater, because anything that's exposed to the air can and will mold.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
But if it's submerged, yeah, it has to be submerged. So,
right.
But definitely, I mean, definitely try it. It's one of my favorite things to do anymore.
Yeah. And so then, you know, I know there's a difference between canning and fermenting, but I don't know what the difference is. I've always seen, I have a friend who writes cookbooks, and her kitchen is like just covered in pots and pans and jars when she's doing that. That looks very laborious. Is that a more laborious process?
I think so. It is. It requires special equipment, because you do have to have the special canning jars and the special lids and rings. It's not difficult, but it does require that you have that particular gear in order to make, you know, in order to process these jars.
Right.
And then, you know, yeah, I guess you think about it two different ways. Once you're done, if you make a jar of jam or a batch of jam and have several jars and you process those in the water bath canner, 10 minutes, you're done. That's going to sit on your shelf and you can use it all winter long.
Right.
You know, whereas fermentation, it's initially you're making it, but it does have to sit out on the counter and you know, at room temperature for, you know, a week or more.
Right.
So
okay.
Maybe it's... You know, time-wise, you know, it might take longer to get that fermented end product, but, you know, there are pros and cons of each.
Right. So I want to talk about growing herbs, because I think herbs make such a difference. They can fancy up really simple dishes. And even I've managed to grow those at home on my kitchen windowsill. So what do you see? I think cilantro was one of the ones that you said is easiest to grow.
Oh, cilantro, that is going to be a contentious thing. Either people love it or hate it.
Oh, okay.
you haven't heard, there's a big debate about the whole cilantro thing. I love it, and I grow it in my garden. You know, there are herbs like that are very, almost kind of soft-leaved. The cilantro and basil are very soft-leaved, and, you know, they grow out in the garden. Those are both pretty easy to grow. The cilantro can... go to seed very quickly. It will make flowers and create seeds very quickly sometimes if it gets hot. It's you know, something to be aware of. But then there are others that are more perennial. The rosemary or thyme or oregano, those are a little bit more woody in their structure, and they will survive season to season.
Oh, okay.
So that, you know, that's the benefit of them, is that they can grow. And it's something even like thyme, all of them, thyme and oregano and rosemary, actually they all can stand in and be a little bit of a landscape plant. So, you know, growing your herb, but they're also part of your landscape and they look pretty.
Yeah, and they smell good. They smell good if you grow the right herbs.
Yes.
Too. So I was chatting with a friend the other day, coincidentally, and she was looking at microgreens and maybe going, developing a microgreen, just a small homegrown service. And I didn't really understand what she meant by microgreens until I read your book. tell us what the difference is between microgreens and sprouts. You talk about that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sprouts are, sprouts don't require any soil to grow. Sprouts are essentially, could be a variety of different kinds of seeds. And some of these are seeds similar to what you would plant out in your garden. You can do radish or broccoli. Or basically, you're wetting those seeds so that they begin to grow. They begin to sprout. And you process several days of letting them get bigger and bigger, and there's a little bit of rinsing involved. But you eat the seed. You eat the entire part of that sprout that you've grown. Microgreens, on the other hand, you're actually growing in a very shallow layer of soil and giving them that base. You typically, and this is just like you would plant them out in your garden. It's the same thing, except that with microgreens, you're growing them very densely packed in a small area, and you're only allowing them to get, you know, maybe 3 or 4 inches tall.
Mm.
I'm shorter, you know, depends what you're growing. But as they get that tall, it's a very thick mat of greens growing, and you snip those off, and you eat that, the microgreen portion of that, the shoots, or they're called different things depending on what you're growing. But you can do that with peas. You can do it with popcorn. Popcorn shoots are delicious. And it's a really, really nice way for people who are limited on space to grow some of their own greens.
Yeah, great. So I want to talk about how we keep produce fresh, because obviously if you're growing your own, it pretty much comes to fruition at the same time, unless you're staggering growth, and you can only do that for so long if it's seasonal stuff. So what tips do you have for keeping, for instance, I'm always throwing out the tail end of lettuce. I saw Martha Stewart once. I never watched her shows, but I just caught a clip of her saying, wrap your celery in aluminum foil and put it in the fridge, and it keeps it fresher, and it does seem to work. So what kind of tips like that do you have, where we can avoid having to throw stuff out, because heaven knows we waste enough food in this country?
Well, one of the things that I do, I have a tendency to try and really eliminate the plastic in my household. So a lot of the things that I bring in, I will dampen a kitchen towel or a tea towel and wrap it in that and keep it in the crisper. That works. I use that method for greens and lettuce and such, so that, you know, that dampness really holds it in there.
Okay.
Things that are that have a little bit of root on them, like your celery that you talk about, or green onions. If you can keep those in just a shallow amount of water, they'll draw that water up, and that will help keep them a little fresher. I just keep them out on the, like green onions, I keep on the countertop, but just in a shallow glass of water.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so what about bananas? You have an abundance of those, I understand, right, where you live?
I
laughed because you said I can't grow tomatoes, but I have an abundance of avocados and bananas. But
right, yeah.
I am like a banana addict. I love bananas, and I have to have a banana a day. But again, even if I buy the green ones, they do not last long. How do you find, what's the best way to keep those as long as you can?
I'm laughing because that is just not a problem here.
It's not?
No, I don't.
Well, you just go pick more, right?
know, as they write that, and if they get too ripe, I always seem to have more coming. You know, the ones that are ripe get thrown in the freezer so that we can use them for smoothies.
Oh, okay. See, that's a good tip.
Yeah. That's just, and you know, you can also, I mean, you can take overripe bananas and freeze them without peeling them, and they will turn black and ugly in the freezer, but then they're just a terrific texture for making banana bread.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, that's a good tip because, you know, I get through a lot of bananas and I hate waste. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is that you have a, one of your sons had, you found that he had food, I'm going to say allergies, because his behavior was affected by what you ultimately found as food dyes. And I think this is really important because, you know, I too had a niece who was diagnosed with epilepsy as a baby, but my sister did some research and she too found that food dye was the issue, and she's never had a fit since she was 2 years old after she stopped eating that food dye. So what was going on with your son and how did you come to this conclusion? What do people need to look for if they see stuff that's, you know, if they have a concern about foods in general?
Yeah, it's so hard because it is a little bit anecdotal.
Right, absolutely.
Just, you know, figuring out what the problem was. We were having, behavior issues and, you know, not anything too terrible, but he would just be bouncing off the walls, crazy energy, couldn't focus. He was hard to be around. You know, that's a terrible thing for a mom to say, but he was hard to be around, and we kept thinking there has got to be something that's setting him off, because there were times when he was okay and then he would go, you know, be a little bit out of control. And so we essentially just started really paying attention. Okay, what did he eat today? What was in that food that he ate? And we thought we were eating a pretty healthy diet, but if we, you know, once we really started looking in and digging in, we realized that just as a for instance, the yogurt that we were eating had food dye in it. Mm. Wasn't just, you know, whole ingredients. It did have that food dye in it to make it look pretty, you know, raspberry pink or whatever. And, you know, with a lot of trial and error and removing things and testing things again, we were able to pin it down and realize that that was what was setting him off, was the food dyes. So, you know, that was kind of a real awakening, a real eye-opening moment for us to realize that what we're putting in our bodies is really impacting our behavior and how we feel.
Yeah, and as you said in the beginning, it's about breaking habits, because, you know, we develop these sweet tooth. I have a terribly sweet tooth. I have to constantly battle that, but a lot of it is breaking habits. I just want to throw this in there real quick because we're almost at the end of our segment, but because I have a lot of friends who have rabbits, and you keep rabbits for their manure. I never would have thought of rabbits and manure, so... How does that work? Because they're such tiny pellets.
But they add up, you know.
Of course, yeah, of course.
I do. That's the reason I keep them. I mean, they're very cute. But you know, we're not butchering them or anything. I just have a couple rabbits that. What I like about them is that I can feed them a lot of greens and stuff that would be considered weeds here. So I'm able to feed them from, you know, on site a lot. A lot of their food is grown right on site.
Right.
And they transform that magically into manure. And the rabbit manure is what they consider a cool manure. So I can take that rabbit manure and put it directly on my garden plant.
Wow.
Can't do with, say, chicken or horse manure, because it really needs to compost and have a chance to cool off a little bit before you use it in the garden.
Right. Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Interesting. Well, the book is packed full of really great tips. So there's how to cook on a campfire. I'm definitely going to be using that and your breakfast burrito recipe. There's natural cleaning products in there, which I know many people, favor today. All kinds of interesting information. So I want to let listeners know they can find out more about you, Chris, at attainablesustainable.net. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
I'd like them to just start paying attention. You know, just start paying attention to where they see they could perhaps make a difference in their lives, whether that's, you know, getting in and using their hands to make things to work on, you know, giving them that good soul, heart soul feeling, or if it's reducing plastic, or if it's growing some of their own food. It's just, you know, giving it that attention as you're doing things, realizing, why am I doing this, and is it serving me still?
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much, Chris Bordessa. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Certainly. Thanks for talking with me.
Sure. And listeners can find out, again, much more about Chris and her work at attainablesustainable.net. You can find us at conversationslive.net. We have over 700 podcasts and more than 1,200 guest interviews. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. Until next week, stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.